Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning in to the conversation, Hawaii Talks. We consider the power of public libraries. A critical fund regarded as the backbone for these revered institutions looks like it's on the chopping block under the Trump administration. The entire staff of the federal agency was just put on administrative leave on Monday, which doesn't bode well. A noted mathematician and author is in town. He stops by our studio to teach us about the joy of the random walk. What's that, you say? Stick around to find out. On the Manu Minute, we introduce you to an invasive bird with a heavy metal haircut, and we revisit our recent series into the state of Hawaii's media landscape. A familiar face and some deep pockets are behind a new online outlet, Aloha State Daily. It is Wednesday, April 2nd, the first day of our spring membership campaign. You know, this week, the Trump administration took aim at the Institute for Libraries and Museums. It put the entire staff on administrative leave on Monday. We talked to Hawaii State Librarian Stacey Aldrich about what impacts it's bracing for the short and long term. She tells us that Hawaii's public libraries are funded to the tune of $1.5 million a year, and the uncertainty about funding already in the pipeline for this fiscal year and for the next is triggering fears about losing what we love about local libraries. Grow up with Saturday morning story time, taken a computer class lately, or ever gone there to help with passports or taxes in the past? What programs are in jeopardy? Well, Aldrich tells us it may vary from state to state.
For Hawaii, it means if they choose not to fund, it means that we will not have $1.5 million available, which we use to create access to resources across all the islands. It used to be that we had magazines in every library. People could do research. We don't have paper anymore, so everything is online. And so we pay for access for everybody to newspapers like New York Times, health and wellness access, legal forms, business development online tools, interactive ebooks that support literacy. Bookflix is one of them. Language learning, support for students, testing resources for students and adults in higher education and career development, genealogy. We just finally, across the state, have a foundation directory for small organizations that are looking for grants. It really affects our ability to provide access to these resources that otherwise people do not have, because we can't pay for it for every single library. And also our integrated library catalog provides access to our materials. So how you do a search on our catalog is affected.
That's a little distressing, I mean, because access is what public libraries are about.
Yes, absolutely. The federal grants are used differently in every state. For us, we are a single statewide public library system, and we're 51 branches across six islands. This kind of access to resources is vital for information, entertainment, and also research and study.
I also know that there are some combined school libraries, right?
Yes, we have 12 public and school libraries across the state.
And so that would be access for the students as well?
Mm-hmm. Those are their libraries, too. Mm-hmm.
The news is still pretty fresh because this just happened. And so what, do we just ask for additional guidance?
We normally receive a grant from the Grants to States program, and it's good for 2 years. So right now we're spending through our FY 2024 funding, and we, again, use it for databases, so it's subscription-based. So we pay and then we request reimbursement for the funding. So what it means is we're not sure if we're going to get the rest of our funding for fiscal 24. And even though a budget was passed, an appropriation was made for IMLS by Congress and signed by the president for the federal fiscal year of 2025, we're not sure if we'll receive the money. So the administration could withhold the money, which would go against the separation of powers, because Congress makes the appropriation and he's already signed off on the appropriation.
And then what happens after that, right? After September, when the continuing resolution ends?
Exactly.
If that money goes away, what then? Does the state then pick up part of this service and fund it?
We will have to make some crucial decisions. Where can we make cuts to afford resources, and which resources will we have to let go of until we find additional funding? Which is distressing to me because, again, these are resources for our communities to help them find the information they need. Some things like legal forms, it's a very well-used database. So we'll have to look at what's being really used and figure out how we can continue. Again, I would hate to see some of these resources go away because they do support our community, especially the foundation directory. We only had it in, I think, two libraries for a while, and there was so much outcry to have access because of the way the subscription runs. You have to have it within the library. We can't offer it online. And so we finally were able to do that, and that would be heartbreaking to take that away from people in the community who are looking for grants.
I just think of, you know, if there are, let's say, remote communities where the mm-hmm. libraries are the lifeline, you know, if that access then is lost, because so much that the libraries can supply enriches the community and enriches, you know, just individuals' lives.
Mm-hmm. Just with a library card. I mean, that's the power of libraries. I think our country is great because of libraries. We offer everyone, no matter who you are, access to information, ideas, news, so that you can make your own decisions and you can be successful. And it's distressing that what is literally budget dust, last year's budget for the Institute for Museum and Library Services with $294 million, for that small amount of money, there's tremendous leveraging of local resources to ensure that libraries can evolve to support their communities. So again, here in Hawaii, we use it to create more access to information and learning. In other states, they use it to keep their Library for the Blind and Print Disabled open to provide services. They use it for all kinds of projects around workforce development, literacy, helping children who have challenges reading for whatever reason. There's amazing programs happening all across this country for $294 million, and that's not just libraries, it's also museums. So the library side is larger between the two programs. There's about $211 million, but that's a small amount of money, and it goes such a far distance to creating equal access and ensuring that the public has resources that they need to be successful.
Well, you brought up the library for the visually impaired, and yeah, I was going to ask about that. Does that affect services like that to our community?
Currently, we do not use any of the IMLS funds for our Library for the Blind and Print Disabled. That is a service out of the National Library Service, which is in the Library of Congress. So it's not clear what will happen to the Library of Congress's budget for coming years, but they could be affected in the future.
Well, I guess if you control the purse strings and are in a position of power, you can dictate, well, this is what we need to do, and that's nice to do, and then you eliminate what's nice to do if, you know, push comes to shove. But it just seems like a terrible Sophie's choice. When you have two children, you don't want to give one up for the other.
And I don't even think it has to be Sophie's choice. I think it's about finding balance between all of the things that support our communities across the country through the federal government, and that balance has to be found. So I don't think it has to be one or the other. I feel like that has been said many times, but it isn't one or the other. It's figuring out what you can support and at what level can you support those things, which have a powerful impact on the communities that are served.
That was Stacy Aldrich, Hawaii State Librarian, talking to us about the power of libraries and free access to information for all. This week, the staff of the Institute for Libraries and Museums, a staff of about 70 people, was put on administrative leave, leaving questions about future funding. What does access to your local library mean to you? We invite you to share what you love about libraries and the worlds that it opens for all of us. Record something on our talkback line or email us at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Confidentially, I'm reading Go, 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 Go!
There's a given tree, a Jumanji, where the wild things are.
All the thoughts and dreams of people throughout history. And all you need is this little card to borrow them for free.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii International Film Festival's Opio Fest, presented by Holly Kulani, with movies from around the world and student films, April 8th to 13th, in person at Consolidated Kahala Theaters, hiff.org.
You are back with the conversation on this Wednesday. Hey, let's get nerdy. Jordan Ellenberg is a mathematics professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the New York Times bestselling author of two books, Talks, How Not to Be Wrong and Shape. He has been visiting the University of Hawaii at Manoa this week as part of the school's 2025 Distinguished Lecture Series in Mathematics. He gave a public lecture on Monday titled From Malaria to ChatGPT, The Birth and Strange Life of the Random Walk. Ellenberg spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about his career starting with his own random walk.
You know, in some ways, I had a very straight path into mathematics. I was always interested in this subject from when I was a child. That's what I majored in when I was in college, and then I got my PhD. So in that sense, it's been very linear, right? Like I sort of did one thing, then the next thing, then I became a professor. And now for about 20 years, I've been a math professor at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. But in another way, there was sort of something a little bit circuitous about it, in that I was always interested in writing. And actually, after college, I went off. I thought I wanted to be a novelist. I went off and did a graduate degree and spent a year writing fiction and trying to develop my ability to like write good sentences and stuff like that. And I missed math every day. It was terrible. I mean, it was good educationally, but I was like unhappy and I wished I were doing math. And that's how I knew that was what I really wanted to do. But I maintained that interest in communication and writing, and sort of eventually that's how I sort of came to this idea of writing books about math, trying to bring what I knew about novel writing. I mean, let me put it this way, like most mathematicians in the United States are also teachers. And as a teacher, it's not really so much that there's some set of information that we're just imparting from my brain to a student's brain. We're storytelling. That's what we do. And when we're teaching something, it's pretty hard to learn unless you feel that there's some reason for you to learn it, that it's part of a story, part of a narrative. That, you know, I always say every single concept in math, we didn't invent it in order to have something to put on a test to sort students from A to B to C to F. Like, that's not the point. Every single concept we have in math was invented by people to solve some problem that they actually had in their real life. So as a teacher, I think you find yourself telling those stories. And then I see writing these books and giving lectures and stuff like that as very continuous with what I do in the classroom.
Then why do you feel like it is that so many people have such negative associations with math that they can't connect the storytelling to it? Do you think it's a matter of their teachers were just trying to cram in so much information they didn't get around to telling them why it mattered? Or is math particularly difficult to bring in the context for?
Well, first of all, math is difficult. That's for sure. But, you know, as I always tell my kids, like every class is difficult if you do it right. You know, if you actually sort of like, you know, rise to the level of your own challenge and find your own kind of mental pain point, that's how you know you're growing intellectually. So, yes, it's difficult, but I don't think it's intrinsically more difficult than really like understanding how to write and how to read closely and how to do science and like all the other things that we do in the classroom. I think maybe what's different is that math does have this feature of having incorrect and correct answers to questions, right and wrong. And I think that for a student, you know, it can be kind of like viscerally unpleasant to kind of say something and be told you're wrong. Like, and it's a challenge. Like, we have to create classrooms where you have that sense of play and fun and it's okay to be wrong, which is certainly the feature of the professional mathematics community. We say wrong stuff all the time. And we're just kind of like talking to each other at the blackboard and working something out and trying to understand something that we don't understand yet, which is what's happening in the classroom. I'll say 20 wrong things a day, you know, in front of my colleagues, in front of my students. And they'll just be like, that can't be right, Ellenberg. Are you sure? And I'm like, no, on second thought, what I said was like complete BS. But I do think actually, to go back to the notion of difficulty, I do think a challenge that we have as teachers, which whether it's K-12 or college, you know, we tend to know math pretty well. And it is a challenge sometimes to remember that something is difficult if you've mastered it. I'll say this. So I took a surfing lesson earlier this week. I'm visiting Hawaii for about a week. And I'm just going to be honest with you. I mean, I'm sure there's better surfing teachers and worse surfing teachers. But I was like, oh, this guy really knows how to surf and he really thinks it's easy. And he's not able to put himself in the mind of somebody from the Midwestern United States who like can barely balance on a stand-up paddleboard to like understand what's difficult about this. And I'm like, oh, this is what it's sometimes like for people learning math. Like, we're the surfers, right? We're just like, what's the big deal? The next step is to get up on the board and stand on it and keep standing on it until the wave is over. I'm like, no, you got to give me a little bit more. Like, I know you know how to do it.
Yeah. It seems to me in preparing a talk like this, you're thinking about all of those things. You're thinking you're basically the professor and the audience is your students, but only for as long as the talk is. But this talk on random walks and its applications throughout modern society, basically, how did the idea to do that come about, and how were you thinking about distilling each of those points through time down in a way that's accessible?
This is a story that I first learned about while I was writing my last book, which was called Shape. And like a lot of things in my books, it did kind of like fall in my lap by good luck. I knew I wanted to write about Random Walk, which, you know, we're not going to give a whole dissertation on the radio with no chalkboard, but it's a very fundamental concept that's used in all kinds of mathematics that studies all kinds of processes that have a random component to them, from the stock market to spread of epidemics, which I might have happened to be kind of interested in when I was writing that book in 2020 or like whatever. So I knew I wanted to write about that mathematical subject. And usually the first place I go is to be like, well, when did people first really understand this? What's the history? And in this case, I sort of happened across this rather remarkable story or set of stories that I tell in the talk, that at the same time around 1905, different scientists in different countries, all completely not knowing about the others, were all developing the same mathematical concept at the same time. And I think I like telling the story because I think it really gets at something that's surprising but very true about mathematics, that sometimes the world is just ready for a new idea.
Mm-hmm. Can you briefly talk about how this concept applies to mosquitoes? Because I think that would be pretty relevant for our audience here, not because there's malaria, but because the mosquitoes are a big menace to the native birds in Hawaii. And I think listeners would appreciate how this concept of random walk applies to this problem.
Okay, I'm going to answer your question, but for how can a mosquito take down a bird?
Oh, is it okay? Avian malaria.
Okay, so I'm learning something now. So you're saying the mosquitoes here do carry malaria, but not the kind that humans get?
Yep.
Oh, if I had known that, I would have put it in my talk. Okay. So yeah, the person who first discovered that mosquitoes were carrying malaria, Ronald Ross, like a famous doctor who won the Nobel Prize, a British doctor, he was a very interesting character, a guy who was about as accoladed and praised as a doctor could be, but he kind of secretly wanted to be a mathematician. He secretly did not think much of medicine. And so he really wanted to develop a mathematical theory of disease spread and things like that. It's kind of crazy given all the amazing stuff that he did. He was like, that's not good enough. I really want to make it mathematics. And so he was interested in, like, if you have some kind of breeding ground for mosquitoes, how quickly are they going to spread out to cover the landscape? Because that's a relevant question, right? If you want to control the mosquitoes. And so he had this rather simple mathematical model where he's like, well, what if the mosquito flies a certain direction each day, a direction chosen at random? And then the next day, it picks a new direction. Could be just backtracking from where it went, could be going on in the same direction, could be moving in some perpendicular direction, whatever. The mosquito picks a new direction and flies that way. And then the next day, same thing. Next day, same thing. And so you ask yourself, well, where's the mosquito going to be after a long time? It's just wandering around aimlessly. Does that mean it kind of stays near where it started? Or does it kind of drift away from its starting point? You'd rather it be the former, right? Because you'd rather the mosquitoes not spread out from their breeding ground too much. Maybe they stay localized. Sadly, that's not the case, sadly. Even in this simple model, mosquitoes do spread out. And we know that that's true in real life too. But if you have a good mathematical model, you can sort of start to ask yourself, well, how fast will they spread? Like, if I clear an area of mosquitoes, like, how long have I bought myself before the area becomes infested again? So he was very interested in this problem, couldn't solve it, wrote to one of the foremost statisticians of his day, Carl Pearson, who publicized the problem and eventually found the solution. But it was interesting. In those days, Pearson said, the mathematicians won't work on it if they know it's about biology. They'll be like, this is like too low rent. Like, we don't work on, we need to work on like pure thought problems. So then the name, the random walk, was actually invented by Pearson. He completely rewrote it to take out any mention of mosquitoes or malaria or infestation, and just said, well, imagine a person choosing a direction to walk. No reason, just like as an abstract concept. And so that's it. So Pearson gave the concept its name.
That same concept underpins how a lot of complex algorithms, artificial intelligence, even large language models operate.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the big things lately, because people are so interested in developments in artificial intelligence, machine learning, and especially large language models, which is just one direction of machine learning, but it's been a particularly fruitful one, people are really interested in this, as they should be, because I think it's a super interesting development. But I think that it's very easy to treat it as like a kind of magic as something that just kind of like came out of the blue and which we can't possibly understand. And like, you know, talking about it from the inside, and I wouldn't say I'm not on the inside and that I don't work at a big tech company, but I've certainly done research with large language models. And the math is not as hard as people think, and it's not as different from other things that have been done before as people think. So one of my goals lately in going around giving these talks is to just try to demystify this a little bit and to show that these kind of pretty simple to describe random processes can actually generate really interesting stuff. And we've actually known that for a long time. That didn't just happen in 2021. I think there's obviously like really exciting new capabilities, but they're kind of better versions of things that came before rather than totally new things. And I want people to know that.
That was best-selling author and mathematician Jordan Ellenberg talking with HVR's Maddie Bender. He's to give a technical seminar at the University of Hawaii this afternoon at 3:30 p.m.
Support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are providing affordable housing solutions to convert renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
You know, this is The Conversation on HPR1. I'm Catherine Cruz. Curious about that black crested bird that you've seen flitting around your Oahu neighborhood? Well, it's likely a red-vented bulbul. And we've got its song today, thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Here's Patrick Hart with your Manu Minute.
If you live on Oahu, you've likely seen red-vented bulbuls around your house, neighborhood, or park. They're about 8 inches long, mostly black, with a red patch under their tail or vent. They're also the only black bird on Oahu with a black crest on its head. Red-vented bulbuls are native to India and Southeast Asia and were introduced to Honolulu as cage birds in the 1950s. The name bulbul comes from a Persian word for nightingale. But the scratchy and throaty calls of the bulbul are not considered by many to be as melodious as those of that well-known bird. Red-vented bulbuls are considered pests, as they love to eat various fruits like guava, lychee, mango, papaya, and even orchid buds, as well as insects and geckos. In Hawaii, red-vented bulbul is on the injurious wildlife list, and they're among the IUCN's list of top 100 invasive species worldwide. In addition to urban areas, they're common in upland forests, where they're known to spread the seeds of a number of invasive plant species. Like all birds, red-vented bulbuls are beautiful in their own way, but we should do our best to keep them from spreading from Oahu to other islands. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Senator Brian Schatz is leading a group to designate this month as Preserving and Protecting Local News Month. The resolution comes at a vital time, he said, as the First Amendment is facing mounting threats. On this first day of our membership campaign, we thought it fitting to bring you a series of recent stories we've done, highlighting the state of the media landscape in Hawaii. Acam Napier is a familiar voice on our airwaves. He was editor-in-chief of Pacific Business News for a decade. Now, he is at the helm of a new online-only publication called Aloha State Daily, financed by Wyoming billionaire B. Wayne Hughes, Jr. We talked with Napier in March about what he hopes the new publication can add to local journalism.
You can find us at AlohaStateDaily.com. We're free to read. We're free to subscribe to our daily newsletter that comes in the morning. You get all our top headlines. And we are just aiming to be the new news for Hawaii. We have 5 reporters. We're at an office downtown on Alakea Street. terrific view. We can see the state capitol, Iolani Palace, City Hall, all those places we need to keep an eye on, right?
You're at the CBB building.
Exactly. You know, we're covering government and politics, real estate, business, the economy, tourism, sports, food and dining, arts, culture, entertainment, just everything that people would be interested in, with more to come. We're going to continue to grow. Coming up soon is our second month anniversary.
Okay.
So we debuted on January 13th.
We've been doing stories about the media landscape, the shrinking landscape, where newsrooms are cutting staff. And yet, in the last few months, we've just seen some new stories online.
Right, right. Well, you know, it's a time of change for sure in the media, and old outlets are adapting and new outlets are popping up. So this is an opportunity that came my way, and I just found it irresistible, a chance to get in on the ground floor of something brand new. You know, my whole career here, a lot of folks at public radio may know me because I have been on the air for so long with you. I'm born and raised here, and I have felt so lucky to be able to stay home and do what I want to do for a living in my own hometown. I was at Honolulu Magazine for 19 years. I was with Pacific Business News for 10. You know, and both of those are legacy outfits with tremendous history behind them, and that's very cool and very exciting. This is my first time starting something, so that's a whole new kind of excitement.
And when I got wind of this, I was told, oh, there's another sister outfit called the Cowboy State Daily.
Right, Cowboy State Daily.
In Wyoming,
so,
right?
Yeah, that's true. So we're privately owned and locally operated, and you know, our investor has ties to Hawaii. He's a high net worth individual. You know, that's about all we say about that. This person would really rather people look at Aloha State Daily and pay attention to the news that we're doing and the work that the crew is doing. Yeah, it's fun to have a sister publication. If you look at them, you see a very, very local publication that reflects Wyoming. And with us, you're going to see a very, very local publication that reflects Hawaii.
Well, Honolulu Civil Beat did a little article mm-hmm. on your funder mm-hmm. talking about his red roots. And, mm-hmm. you know, they point out that they have a funder, Pierre Omidyar,
right.
who has blue roots. You
right,
know, but
right.
they say they have a firewall to make sure that mm-hmm. things are straight and narrow.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, that's the way to go. What our goal is on the reporting side is to tell people what happened and not how to feel about what happened. Not what to think about what happened. You know, that's for the reader to decide. It takes some discipline to do that because everybody has their biases. You know, I do. I'm sure all the reporters do. Everyone in our industry has bias one way or another. And then as we grow, you know, we're starting to add some voices, community voices side, and we'll be adding columnists as well. This week, we debuted a new column from Lopaka and Tanya Kapanui. It's a ghost column because Hawaii history
yes.
and ghost stories, we love that sort of thing. And we're starting to bring in some viewpoints from around town. Those tend to be reprints of things that we think readers would be interested in. To start, we have Grassroots Institute and Tax Foundation of Hawaii. And I'm easily reachable, Cam, at AlohaStateDaily.com. Email me if you're involved with an organization that has a viewpoint on things and you'd like to get that out, because we would love to have a wide range of opinion on the opinion side. So the reporting is just what happened or what's coming up on the arts and entertainment and the food and dining side and the sports side. We're going to tell you about things you can go experience and enjoy. And on the opinion side, we want a wide range. And, you know, I may even be popping into that space once in a while myself. That would be fun.
And we've been hearing from Akam Napier, editor-in-chief of Aloha State Daily. We will return to our conversation after a message from Liberty and John at the pitch table.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
You are back with The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. And let's get back to our discussion with Akam Napier, editor-in-chief of a new online local news outlet for Hawaii. It is called Aloha State Daily. We asked him about the shrinking media landscape here. Is digital the future?
Well, we're online only. There's no print edition. This is the first time I've done a media appearance, and I didn't have a copy of what we do that I brought with me because it's on the internet, right? So people read us online. From the stats, I can tell that they're reading us through their phones primarily, even more than desktop. People are reading us through the email newsletter. So yeah, you know, a lot of the legacy outfits, there is remaining momentum behind the revenue streams that they get from the advertising on their legacy product, whether it's a printed newspaper or a television broadcast, a radio broadcast. But those things come with some fairly steep expenses as well that you're chained to and can't exactly control. So the price of electricity for the broadcast folks, paper, printing, ink, distribution for the print media folks. So our business plan is to grow an audience and sell advertising and be self-sustaining and self-supporting and profitable in the long run. And I feel very optimistic about that.
Yeah, you know, learning last year that the Star Advertiser was not going to be doing home delivery in Waikiki, and that just was like jarring to me, like, you're just not going to deliver. That to me is just very fascinating and, you know, thinking, wow, is this the beginning of the end?
Well, it may be the beginning of the end for certain formats, but I think it's the beginning of the beginning for new ways to do journalism and reach people where they are and where they're reading, where they're living, where they're hearing about things. You often hear people say, oh, I get my news from social media. Well, social media doesn't actually employ any reporters. What I think they often mean is that they saw a journalistic enterprise doing some reporting, and that headline was on social media, right? So we're on four major channels. You know, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, LinkedIn, we're on X. So if someone sees our stories there, they might say, yeah, I get my news from social media. But really, and ideally, I hope that they're going to come and get it from us.
Anything about the trends, though, nationwide, I guess, that strikes you at this point as you try and launch this news organization?
Well, I think it's an exciting time to start something new. You know, there's a lot of change in the air, some of which you see Bezos making changes at Washington Post or the big cable stations and what they're doing with their staffing levels. And then there's whole new things like Substack, right? So there's a lot of people who left legacy outfits and really went into business for themselves. And some have been quite successful at that, right? You can subscribe to a writer on Substack for a small amount of money. And if you get 100,000 people paying a small amount of money, it can really add up for some of these folks. So there are independent journalists out there. There's definitely space for startups like we have. And there's a big appetite there in Hawaii for new, right? We've been using the tagline, the new news for Hawaii. And we're hoping that people read us to get exactly that. What we'd like to offer people is our curiosity about the beats that we cover, our access to the people that we're able to reach. Maybe the idea that we would be asking different questions of the sources than other outlets might ask. Because one thing that goes on too as media shrinks is that their teams get smaller. They can't be everywhere. They can't look at everything. So we've had a couple of things just in our first early weeks here that I haven't really seen a lot of coverage on around town. Kaloa Rum just filed a lawsuit against the federal government over the Jones Act, right? Now that's something Hawaii's been talking about for decades. And here we have a local business on Kauai that's actually doing something about it.
Right, that's not fair.
And so that was really interesting. That caught our eye. There was a protest over that House Bill H1118 about the religious exemption to vaccines. And I don't know that other people really covered the fact that there had been a protest or, you know, what people were concerned about. So things like that, right, where we can be everywhere. You know, one of the fun things about our location is when there is a protest downstairs at the Capitol, you know, if we've got time and somebody free, we'll just go downstairs, no matter what that thing is, that protest, and just ask people, hey, what's on your mind? What brought you out today? So we had an article about the Onipa'a Peace March, spent some time downstairs then, and same with the protest about the vaccine exemption.
That was Cam Napier, a familiar face and voice in the Hawaii media scene, who is now the editor of the new publication Aloha State Daily. And that wraps it up for us today. I'm Catherine Cruz,